It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, once again, we're joined with George Tikkurel Omar, and unfortunately, George, it seems like every time we talk to you, something bad is happening at your workplace. We're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today. We're going to be talking about what's been going on at your work, also mass shootings in general. I really kind of want to ask you about just your thoughts about why this keeps happening in especially American society. Also, you know, with Richard Spencer recently coming to the Florida campus in Gainesville, just kind of looking at how campuses are reacting to fascist, alt-right, and far-right speakers, and how that relates to your case. And moreover, just kind of, again, looking at the tenor of the country, especially what Bannon is trying to do and some other things. So let's just get into it. What is your current situation where you work, and what was the official reasoning for you being taken out of your classes?
So shortly after this sort of, outrage emerged, stoked by all the same media outlets as normal, these sort of, you know, the Daily Callers of the world, and then transitioning into Fox News, I was sort of summarily suspended from work. I was put on forced administrative leave. My classes were at first going to be canceled, leaving my students sort of in the middle of the quarter without the classes they had signed up for. And this was kind of stunning, in part because there's no basis for it. And the argument from the university was that this was because of threats and danger. Even if this were plausible, I mean, this is not what you do, right? You don't cave to sort of terroristic threats from fringe right-wing white supremacists on a college campus. You don't say, all that you have to do is threaten us and we'll give you exactly what you want. This is sort of a recipe for disaster. And yet this is, in some ways, this is the tack taken by many universities, you know, since they've been, you know, increasingly managed as PR firms that are trying to head off controversy, avoid controversy at all costs. And what they end up doing is actually against their own best interests, just sort of spurring on more controversy and encouraging more threats and encouraging more hate mail. So, at the moment, however, my students mobilized very quickly. They did a sort of sit-in in class with signs asking where their professor was. They, you know, hassled the administrators and pressured them to continue the classes. They even, from what I understand, were unwilling to sign up for other classes to replace these classes. And so finally, the university relented and reinstituted my classes in online format. I'm still banned from campus. I'm not allowed to go to my workplace. I'm expected to teach my classes online, which is also a disservice to my students. And all this is based on really silly claims about threats. And I'm used to threats. It's nothing new. It's not that it's irrelevant or not that it's a good thing, but it's the threats that were received over the past couple of weeks are really no different from previous waves of right-wing outrage stoked by this outrage machine. And it's mostly sort of keyboard warriors who are never going to do much of anything. And so, especially to cancel classes, to create a dangerous precedent and to do such a disservice to my students over this is really absurd.
So you're not allowed on campus, but you're still expected to teach the classes.
Weird, right?
Online. So you're still expected to work. You just physically cannot come into your workplace and you have to work from a computer, basically.
Right, which is pretty dope, actually, because, like, you know, it's my aspiration to live without pants at all times. And so, you know, So right. If there's no pants required, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty ideal.
Maybe they
no, but seriously though, this is not good for my students. This is not good for universities. This is not good for academic freedom. It would be shocking to think, you know, that this is what universities would be doing in the year 2017.
And to be clear, the tweets that were taken out of context, what people on the right are saying is essentially that you were saying that basically the people that died in Las Vegas deserved it because in theory they were Trump supporters.
Didn't say a fucking thing like that. Right, it was amazing. I literally said, so here's what I said, right? I said, listen, we know, and this is something I had asked my students just days before that in class. I didn't even tell them the answer. I asked them the question and they gave the answer, the answer that no one else seems to be willing to give. I said, why is it that disproportionately white men engage in these sort of mass shooting sprees? There are disputes about the numbers. They're difficult. You know, it's kind of hard to categorize sometimes what mass shootings are, depending on what your threshold is. But, you know, I raised this question to my students, and within about 5 minutes, we had teased out the fact that it had everything to do with a certain kind of entitlement, right? That when frustrated gets very dangerous. If you think that you're entitled to have a very privileged place in the world, whether it's in gender or racialized terms, whether you're, you know, the top of the race hierarchy or the dominant sort of male, then you find your life to not actually reflect those things sometimes. This can lead to a building up of dangerous frustration, right? This can lead to, and again, this is no surprise to anyone. This entire Hollywood genre of the angry sort of upper middle class white male who loses his shit. Like, this is not a new thing. It was not even a controversial thing. And it's something that's, of course, well backed up with thousands of pages of scholarship. So these were not controversial tweets. What happened is that they were chopped up to first make it sound, the initial headline said that I was blaming white supremacist patriarchy, which is accurate, but of course that's not catchy enough for the mainstream.
Right.
And so then they had to claim that I blamed it on Trump, which is not true either. I talked about Trumpism as a dynamic, and actually what I said was that this understanding of white male entitlement was a huge part of Trumpism. In other words, the arrow going in the other direction. Not that Trumpism was causing even what was happening in Vegas. And then finally, of course, that I blamed Trump must have meant that I blamed the victims themselves. And this is what they're saying on Fox News, which is something that is idiotic. I would never have said it.
So why does this keep happening in our society? I mean, why do we keep seeing mass shootings again and again? I mean, especially with this last person. I mean, he's a multimillionaire. You know, he's a professional gambler. He owns planes. I mean, in many people's eyes, like, you know, this baby boomer guy was kind of living the American dream. So, I mean, but why does this keep happening again and again? And is this simply like the new and improved version of the serial killer that we've been seeing kind of build up over the last couple of decades? And why do people feel like they need to go out and like take literally almost, you know, over like 60 people with them? And I mean, it's really horrific.
It really is. It's fucking insane. Like, this is the question, right? It points to something deeply sick in our society. And I think the people that think that, that I was trying to belittle it or something are really missing the point. I want to take this shit seriously and figure out what the hell is going on. The problem is that no one, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, wants to actually figure it out because they want to think about real questions. Democrats want to talk about gun control. And yeah, if this dude didn't have like all these weapons and bump stocks and everything, he wouldn't have killed as many people, but he would have killed a pretty horrific number of people regardless, right? You know, and so that's not a solution to the question of why people do this kind of stuff. Some people on the right in particular were pointing toward my discussion of entitlement and saying, well, how was he frustrated? You know, how did he not get what he wanted out of life? He was rich. He was all these things. Well, I mean, fine. But like, that doesn't explain why, as we've heard, that he sort of was violently misogynistic toward his girlfriend in public constantly. Right. Because this is about power. It's not about your actual concrete things. It's about your sense of entitlement to a certain kind of power. And the thing about expectations and entitlement is that it's not a concrete measure that if you're rich, then you suddenly don't feel frustrated. No, these things are built upon understandings of what you want, and those expectations keep increasing and the pressure keeps increasing to fulfill them. And it's a psychosis that we need to really understand collectively as a society. And this is what no one really wants to talk about. We live in a sick society. And, as Frantz Fanon once put it, talking about Algeria, he said a society that drives its members to desperate solutions is a society to be replaced. In other words, we need to look at this social structure and say what needs to be torn down, dismantled, and replaced in this social structure, given that we see symptoms like this happening in the world. You know, these things don't happen for no reason. Of course, I'm a little ambivalent on gun control, to be honest. I'm being painted as a sort of a rabid gun nut on the left. But I mean, to be real, I don't have super, super strong feelings. What I have strong feelings about is this liberal discourse, which is pure escapism, that says if we pass gun control laws, this won't happen. Or if we pass gun control laws, then we can be like Sweden, or we can be like some other country. And the reality is the logical fallacies and steps that occur along the way of these kind of thought processes are a huge stretch. In other words, firstly, what kind of gun control is feasibly passable in the United States? Very limited. Will that gun control then be able to remove from circulation the millions and millions of guns already held by people, particularly, white men? Absolutely not. And so we're looking at a situation that is in no way comparable statistically or in any other way with England or Australia, these other cases that people try to use. And so unless we have real solutions to prevent these things from happening and to get really at the root problems, then, this is going to keep happening because our society is just getting sicker. The more that we focus on these sort of, these sort of surface level solutions.
Right. And obviously the state is very happy to respond with only more and more of its own violence in turn.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what, we act as though when we're calling for gun control, that we're calling for some kind of uniform gun control, when, of course, the police and the military remain heavily armed. And that's why I think, some people quite rightly are like, yeah, cool. Like, I'm for gun control if you disarm the police at the same time. If you disarm the military at the same time, or even if you just ensure that there's a way to disarm white men at the same time. Come on, I'm down for that.
Well, the SPLC recently released a report about a church shooting that happened not long ago that was carried out by an African-American man, supposedly in response to Dylann Roof, and they claimed that it was linked to a rise in violent black nationalist groups. At the same time, a report was released by the FBI about quote-unquote black identity extremists. What do you make of this, both of these kind of pushes to label African-Americans as, a rising bed of extremism and violence?
I mean, of course, these are incredibly dangerous precedents to be setting. This points us in the direction of counterinsurgency campaigns against the Black Panther Party that were extermination campaigns. And this is something we need to fight back against. But it also points toward, I think, at the beginning, I talked about some of the difficulties of the numbers on mass killings. Because it's, and this is where we get, you can't just take these mass killings and say, oh, here's a mass killing, therefore it's comparable in its causes, in its motivations to this other mass killing, right? I think when you look at many mass killings carried out by black people, what you find are very different motivations, right? You find people often motivated by racism itself, right? You find people who are taking, again, desperate solutions, but to the actual sort of racist structure of society and sort of lashing out against it. You saw even Chris Dorner, if people remember the Dorner, right. Situation, was motivated in many ways by discrimination and racism. And that doesn't mean that the solutions that are sought are rational or reasonable or, proportional in any way. It's really hard to compare that to a frustrated, rich white dude who goes on a shooting rampage and kills like random people. These are very, very different phenomena. And this is the real complicated question because it makes it hard to look at statistics and numbers and say that they're accurate. You've got the right and this, of course, the mantra on the right is, what about Chicago, right? In other words, what about so-called black on black crime? Right. And yet this is, you know, this is grounded in the assumption that just because black people are killing black people, that white supremacy is not the cause. When you look at the way that, you know, the history of Chicago, you know perfectly well that white supremacy is the cause of this horizontal violence, what Fanon would call horizontal violence, among the black community. And so, you know, what people are understanding to be different phenomena are actually the same in that case. And what a lot of people are grouping together as the same phenomena, we have to understand as in many cases very different.
Let's kind of turn back to your case with getting taken off campus. How does the rank-and-file alt-right neo-Nazi trolls fit into larger formations like Turning Point USA, Campus Reform, or people like Tucker Carlson? I mean, how does this engine actually work together, either in your case or others, with other professors?
I mean, the first thing to understand is that there is it's really a small group on this sort of right-wing fringe, and it has a great deal of, you know, deep relationships and porosity, and, you know, they feed stories back and forth to each other. In this most recent case of mine, it began with the Daily Caller, which, if people didn't know, was founded by Tucker Carlson, and remains a smaller outlet on the right, but then pushes these stories into the other, you know, into the other outlets, into Breitbart, which we know has an entry point into mainstream political life because Steve Bannon, you know, was in the White House. Right. And then we know, of course, obviously the Daily Caller has some kind of leverage to get things into Fox News, which is what eventually happened. And so I think you realize how inbred this whole, you know, circle is once I then get invited to be on Tucker Carlson after the controversy blows up into a Fox News thing. And I'm like, motherfucker, you like invented the Daily Caller as a way of creating and looking for these clickbait fringe type stories to then, you know, push in and hope they cross the threshold into Fox. And once Fox gets them, then they turn it into something entirely different. And then they sort of really make people's lives a living hell, not because they're saying the most sort of like frothingly radical things, but because they're saying it to such a major audience that people sitting on their couch decide it's time to pick up the phone or pick up their email and you know, and send off a threat. And that's precisely what, you know, what happened. We've seen in these leaked documents on BuzzFeed that, you know, that between the alt-right and Breitbart, there was a direct connection. And Breitbart was consciously playing the role of, you know, of mediator and sanitizer of white supremacy to push it into the mainstream. Like, we've been saying that this whole goddamn time.
Right.
And now the documents prove it, right? That Milo himself played a huge role in courting the alt-right, the white supremacist right, allowing them and allowing their voices to be injected into the mainstream. And that's clearly been what's happening. And that's been the strategy of the alt-right, right? Mm-hmm. When they say something like white genocide, what that allows them not to say is white supremacy. What that allows them not to say is Heil Hitler, right? It allows them to say something that is sanitized just enough so that your everyday white person that feels like they hate, you know, affirmative action or that the world is stacked against them somehow, is able to connect with that sentiment. And that's where the alt-right has this kind of Trojan horse strategy, where they want to use these ideas that are sanitized ideas as a way of mainstreaming real fundamental white supremacy. And they've been very successful at doing that.
Do you feel that the administrators on college campuses, do they actually sit down and think about, you know, like when they start to receive threats and complaints against somebody like you, are they actually thinking about like the entire issues, or is it just like a calculus with them where they get a certain amount of complaints and then they start to take action?
I mean, they think, of course, and they strategize, but they strategize in a wrong-headed way that leads them to actually make bad calculations. And this is where I think the message, I hope, is increasingly clear to university administrators. Because, for example, when the white genocide thing happened, someone, it's still not clear, in the university communications office wrote up a denunciation of my tweet without having the slightest idea what it was about. And this was not written by an academic or any kind of academic officer, and it was run as a PR move, an attempt to head off a controversy. And what it did was stoke that controversy. It encouraged threats against me. It made this into a much bigger deal than it would have been otherwise, and it created academic backlash against people, you know, against the university for, of course, commenting on extramural speech of faculty members. So it was a terrible calculation, no matter how you look at it. It didn't do even what the university wanted it to do. I thought that lesson was learned. However, I think we see You know, we see something similar playing out today. You know, when your primary goal is PR, and when you have no real understanding of how these media groups operate, or how they generate online controversy, then you're bound to, you know, to make mistakes and to make bad calculations. It was recently revealed that, you know, that a Russian bot farm was driving the white genocide controversy. And this really, I think, just underlines the foolishness of the university, because it said, oh, well, we've gotten so, you know, 500 emails or something like that, or 1,000 emails even. Therefore, something real must be happening, when in reality, what was happening is that there was a manufactured controversy that was amplifying an outrage, manufacturing, creating, inventing an outrage. And this is what the university responded to, the sheer bulk of the emails. And so if that's how it's going to work, then it's going to be, you know what, it's going to be very easy to create outrages. It's going to be very easy to, you know, to stoke this kind of outrage on the right or the left. Right. And if universities don't figure out how to deal with that or how to see through the hype, then there is actually no way they're going to navigate these waters in any effective way.
And you brought up the issue of the Russian bot farms. Can you just talk a little more about that? Because there's been a lot of interesting articles that have come out recently about Russian-based either Twitter bots or Facebook stuff on social media that are pushing things very much so in the vein of the right. I think at the same time, a lot of people are very cautious to kind of like jump on anything like with Russia in the title, because of just, you know, the way the Democrats have kind of pushed their own analysis of the situation. Can you just speak a little bit about why it is important to look at where the stuff is coming from?
Yeah, no, and I'm someone who's skeptical of that whole Democratic Party discourse about Russia, in which Russia seems to be to blame for everything, you know.
Right.
But when in this situation where it seems clear that, you know, the point is not so much that it's tied to Russia, although that's, I'm sure, particularly embarrassing for Drexel to have responded, you know, and caved to Russian bots. You know, the bigger issue is that they've, you know, essentially been so naive as to think that 1,000 emails means 1,000 emails. In other words, means 1,000 outraged individuals, or such and such number of retweets are that many angry, you know, white Americans, you know, when you've got literally non-human actors and paid agents of governments intervening to jack these numbers up. And this is actually, this happens all the time. This happens in congressional races in the U.S., where bots and other, you know, mechanisms are used to generate the feeling, just a sense in the air that something important is happening, or that there's some support or opposition to such and such a cause. And this is something that people are really just beginning to understand, I think, the ways in which we do still respond to perceptions about, you know, about what people are feeling and thinking. And we feel as though, you know, we need to respond to those things. And yet, if those are being manufactured and amplified in different ways, then we, you know, there's, you know, we're being taken for a ride, essentially.
How did we get to a situation where, like, UC Berkeley is giving almost $1 million, or is putting up almost $1 million for security, or in Gainesville we saw about $500,000 to $600,000? I mean, I think for most people it's hard to wrap their minds around it that the university would put so many resources towards this. I mean, how did we get to this point, and what do you think is going through their heads about why they feel that so much resources need to be put towards facilitating and also giving security for these alt-right celebrities?
I mean, speaking of being taken for a ride, the alt-right is engaged in a conscious provocation campaign on campuses, and universities are falling for it hook, line, and sinker. The point of what the alt-right is doing on campus is to provoke. The point is to create these conflicts. And I think, you know, I mean, I think universities on some level recognize that, but they think they have only one option, which is to not, in a way, take the bait of refusing access to campus, thinking that the fallout of that is going to be worse. But the reality is that there is another option, which is to, you know, to actually take a principled stand, to push back, to fight back, to fight in court, even. I mean, universities, public universities are worried about being sued, but you know, the reality is, you know, once they start to sue, and once other universities right now are refusing to host Richard Spencer for security reasons, right? It's not that there are no options for universities. Other universities have passed these security costs on to Spencer and others, onto Milo, and have insisted that if they want to be there, they come up with this money. And, you know, that's another option. But universities instead are too cowardly to really take these stands. And so they find themselves in situations like what happened at the University of Florida, which is not a situation that a university should be in, where they are hosting an open white supremacist who calls for ethnic cleansing. You know, their students should not have to deal with that. You know, and when their students are trying to shut that down, attempting to shut it down, they find themselves then policing their own students who have every reason to be outraged. And this is a university campus. This is where ideas and intellectual debates are supposed to happen. It's not where people are supposed to come and be able to preach the genocide of black and brown students, you know, just because of so-called free speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the instance of Berkeley, I mean, that Free Speech Week was used as a context to beat up people, put up flyers, you know, harass various student organizers and all that stuff. But none of that really was addressed by the campus, and it seems like the violence and the harassment that came out of that, you know, was never talked about, or it's never put into the conversation. And they seem more concerned about facilitating and being nice to the people that are coming in to speak than they are about their own student safety.
Absolutely. And this is why we speak about platform, right? This is why we don't talk about free speech. This isn't about free speech. Milo and Richard Spencer can stand on a street corner and talk shit all day long if they want. Someone might punch them in the face. That would be kind of a good solution, but that person would not have violated their free speech rights because that person is not the government. And yet, when we get to situations like this, what we're talking about is the privileged platform that these speakers are claiming. There's a difference between free speech in the First Amendment and the right to speak on campus and spout Nazi garbage to a university audience and be paid for that. These are very, very different things. And yet, you're right, when a lot of these universities seem more concerned about preserving the second, in other words, the right to the platform, than they are concerned about even preserving the free speech rights of their own students to protest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, the ironic thing is that if they would provide no security, no police, I mean, these events would be over before they even started because there'd be so many more people that would just be there to shut the whole thing down.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's two clashes of speech, right? You know,
right.
There's this whole bullshit idea of what they call the heckler's veto, which says, no, you have free speech and you know, the right to protest, but if you get too loud, then you've crossed the line into something different. And that doesn't say that in the First Amendment. It doesn't really, you know, right, make any sense. It doesn't make much sense in terms of either U.S. history or the dignified history of resistance to oppression that many of us claim, in which speech is often rowdy and is often confrontational. And that's the best and most important kind of speech. And so that's the kind of speech that we need to protect for our students.
Well, looking at Gainesville, especially like with the huge police buildup that we saw, or also Berkeley as well, I mean, what did the police get out of this? And what did the university officials get out of this? I mean, what did they get out of, you know, shutting down parts of the campus of somebody like Ben Shapiro, which most people don't care about? I mean, what's their dog in that fight?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, especially universities that have specific police forces have been subject to a lot of the same dynamics as other police forces, which is you have access to this militarized budget. You have since September 11th in particular, you have to spend that money or it won't be re-upped. You have to maintain that equipment. And so there's this tendency, this built-in tendency to seek out a higher level of, you know, of militarization. And there's a financial incentive to do that. Now, what that means, you know, what the advantage of that is for a university campus is really a good question because, you know, I've been involved on struggles on the Berkeley campus since around, you know, 2004 or 5, particularly in 2009 when there were, you know, major student occupations. And the UC police force, you know, has proven itself to be as inept as any other. And, you know, the idea that they need any kind of, you know, specialized hardware to carry out the policing of protest on campus really points toward what the, you know, what they see as the major concern. You know, campuses are, of course, we know this, hotbeds of sexual assaults and other, you know, violence, including racial violence. And yet the emphasis and the energy and the policing is more often than not falls onto political students who want to mobilize, who want to be disruptive, and who want to do so for social change. And the fact that universities find this so concerning, and the fact that the chancellor at UC Berkeley, you know, wants to, you know, make statements denouncing the protesters for shutting down Milo or wanting to shut down Milo, really shows where their priorities are.
I was curious. I know you've brought up the Campus Anti-Fascist Network in the past. I mean, do you have any thoughts looking at the massive success of Gainesville? I mean, we're hearing reports of between 1,000 and 2,000 people that were out in the streets. And also just the fact that there was about 20 to 25 people on the alt-right that seemed to come out. And it just seemed not only a failure for them strategically, but also in terms of numbers, they didn't have many people out. And I'm just curious about your thoughts about the possibilities of anti-fascist organizing specifically on campus itself.
Yeah, I think we are in a period of the fragmenting and the fracturing of the alt-right, and this is a good thing. It's also a dangerous moment in the sense that that means that, you know, we saw these followers of Richard Spencer, you know, literally shooting at people. And so it's going to be, you know, that kind of frustration and fragmentation is going to give rise to some pretty extreme solutions on the part of these white supremacists who have been mobilized, who have been now shut out of the Trump administration, who are now being shut down by masses of people. We need to understand that that's dangerous, but it's also a good thing. We need to drive home that victory and continue to disrupt and destroy, you know, these movements of the far right. But it also points toward, I think, and we saw this more recently in Berkeley and Boston and other places, that the ability to mob for Antifa, to mobilize in relation to and with the protection of the masses of the people. And that's crucial. You know, anti-fascist organizing cannot be a small isolated phenomenon, but also needs to take refuge in the people as broader, you know, support for opposing fascism. And that, you know, appears to have happened in Gainesville, and it happened in other places. And it, you know, is a way of very effectively showing that these alt-right movements are not going to get the mass traction that they want to have. And making that point perfectly clear.
Turning now to the Intercept, they published an article that attacked you and basically said, like, oh, this whiny professor that doesn't want free speech for anybody now has his free speech taken away. Also, there was a quote in there where they quoted you in the last podcast that we did.
Listening right now.
Hello, Intercept. I just want to take a minute to say, fuck the Intercept, but also, how do you think that we should respond to these publications that kind of dance this line of, you know, oh, we're progressive, or, you know, we do investigative reporting, but really when you get to the heart of them, they really are, pitted against social struggles and movements. I mean, these are very liberal, projects and organizations. I mean, they see themselves as kind of the actors that will bring about change through writing things that will generate policy shifts and stuff like that. But they really are opposed to the self-organization of poor, oppressed, and working class people.
Yeah, no, I mean, for investigative journalists, I mean, this is like hardly investigation. Right. It's really kind of absurd. I have a good friend who said, you know, listen, if this is what he gets paid to do, shit, anyone could do it. I could do it.
Right.
And that's kind of true, because this most recent piece by Zahid Jilani is just like a flaming trash heap of, like, not only bad, you know, journalism, not only bad writing, but also just like bad thinking and bad ideas. Because if you start from that, basically the headline that says professor who doesn't believe in free speech has his taken away. You managed to make two mistakes in the course of like less than 10 words, right? In which, I my free speech was not taken away by my university. My university used the threats of violence from the alt-right as a pretext for removing me from campus. I mean, they didn't even say anything about speech. They won't say anything about speech. Now, is it about speech? Yes, absolutely. But it's more importantly about academic freedom, which is a category that Jilani seems incapable of grasping. And this is why when he says, I don't believe in free speech, no, like, of course, like, free speech is a category governing our life in the United States under the First Amendment. And yet, for the most part, particularly on private university campuses, we're talking about academic freedom. We're not talking about free speech. If I were fired from my job. I cannot sue based on free speech, based on the First Amendment, because that's not how private universities work. So he's literally just wrong about so many things. And not to mention the fact that when then Greenwald comes out to try to defend him and says, oh, look, George doesn't believe in free speech. And he quotes a tweet where I say that free speech absolutism is not a leftist position. Well, no, that's free speech absolutism. That's precisely the elevation of free speech to be a principle, you know, that stands above all others. And that is not a left-wing position, because the left is for building, you know, building revolutionary movements to transform the world and to build an actual leftist program, not standing up for and going out of our way to defend Nazi speech, which is unfortunately what a lot of people, Li Fang in particular at The Intercept, spend their time doing. You know, Li Fang has spent more energy denouncing Antifa than he has spent denouncing fascists. Right. And he spent more, you know, more energy sort of leading our energy, you know, sort of misdirecting outrage against Antifa, or, you know, trying to shift the blame, you know, against the movements themselves, while those movements are in the street doing the very courageous work of actually fighting, you know, fighting fascism. And so it's tough to know what to do with these, because there's definitely some good work that comes out of places like The Intercept. And yet when it becomes so clear that their editorial process is either so weak, or, you know, like, you know, like, you know, or just like non-existent, that this is the kind of trash that gets published, then it's hard to know what to do. So Jelani reached out to me for a quote. Of course, he's the last person who should be writing an article about me, because he's been beefing with me on Twitter for like a year. and yet, for some reason, that's okay for The Intercept to send a totally biased, you know, journalist out to write a hit piece. Now, he reaches out for a quote. He says, has your opposition to free speech changed at all because of this? And I was like, well, since I'm not opposed to free speech, like, this is a stupid question, I'm not going to answer. And then I get an email from someone else at The Intercept saying, hey, any desire to comment? And I say, well, who's writing the piece? And he's like, oh, Jelani is writing the piece. I was like, well, then why are you reaching out for the quote? Come on. Like, come on. This is like, not only is it, you know, bad journalism, but it's really honestly sneaky, gotcha, you know, yellow journalism at that point, where you've got people sneaking around trying to find quotes to participate in their own, you know, hit piece that, you know, it's just not, it's garbage.
You know, this is kind of a tangent, but do you see people on the left, revolutionaries, anti-capitalists, communists, anarchists, do you see us as having a stake in like this ongoing tension around, you know, quote, the culture war? Or do you think that we need to be thinking about kind of how to punch through that and to be like, actually, it's about people and communities doing things against this crisis of capital, and, you know, it looks like this? Or do you think it's both?
I mean, I think it's definitely both, in the sense of, like, if I take what you mean by culture war, I mean it could refer to a few different things, but I think one important one is the ways in which, and people have talked about Richard Spencer in regard to the ways in which Richard Spencer says, no, you know, I'm doing identity politics for the right, right? Mm-hmm. And Richard Spencer, you know, in the alt-right, has been very effective at pointing toward, for example, liberal campus culture of, you know, trigger warnings and cultural appropriation and these kind of things. And we need to understand the ways in which, you know, it is and has to be both, that we need to build revolutionary movements as a way to avoid, you know, falling into some of these, you know, useless fights that, you know, that end up becoming fodder for the right, or end up becoming fodder for dismissing campus culture or dismissing left-wing movements. And we need to do that, but we don't do that by denouncing the students or denouncing, you know, the things that they are coming to think of as important as they radicalize. But we come to it by actually helping to build movements that are doing real things in the world. And the good thing is that when you have like anti-fascist movements on campus, that's a great way for students who otherwise may be complaining about the lack of trigger warnings on their syllabus to, you know, to be engaged in something real, right?
Right. Well, let's turn now a little more towards national topics. I want to talk about getting your thoughts about Bannon's new strategy. He's kind of thrown his hat behind Roy Moore. And also, he was recently at the California GOP conference in Orange County, denouncing, the leaders of Silicon Valley tech capital, which had become a moving force within the Democratic Party. What do you see with this kind of new push for him to build like a coalition between, you know, basically people on the far right of the Republican Party and also with evangelicals. I mean, this is pretty scary stuff. What are your thoughts on his new moves after leaving the White House?
I mean, I think it's the same move, right? Like, it's not, I don't think it's necessarily a completely new move. I think, you know, he's redirected some of his anger, of course. You know, he's now able to speak more openly about being actually opposed to the Republican establishment in a certain kind of way. But this is what he was doing to begin with. I think, you know, it is dangerous. I think it's powerfully dangerous. And sort of like I said before, on the one hand, I think it points also toward his isolation on some level. He came to the White House in such a peculiar moment. And I think he knows that that moment won't be reproduced anytime soon. But he's leaving that moment and using that leverage to build powerful, dangerous relationships, which is in a similar thing to what the Richard Spencers of the world are doing, that they've got this sort of cultural cachet now based on what happened over the last 6 months. And now they're going out in the world to try to use that to the most devastating ends possible. And so I think we need to be super aware of that. We need to be straightforwardly clear about the fact that Bannon himself is a white supremacist, has been a white supremacist. And we know this now, confirmed through these documents that have been leaked. But, you know, he's one of those dangerous people in the country because he is able to mobilize in a very specific kind of way this white fear.
It's interesting because it very much feels that part of Bannon's strategy is kind of this quasi, quote unquote, class politics or, you know, I mean, it's so ironic. Just, you know, somebody that used to work for Goldman Sachs is then turning around and talking about free trade agreements as, you know, economic hate crimes and stuff like that. But I'm just curious if you have any thoughts. Like, I think one of the things that we really need to do is attack like this idea of, quote, economic nationalism. Because not only has Trump not really done that much, but I mean, even what people like Bannon are proposing is not going to offer the everyday American worker anything. But then not only that, you know, also like compared to the Democrats, I mean, at least the Republicans are going to have, you know, that kind of rhetoric in their in their corner. And I think that people are going to be attracted to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got Bannon and others, you know, appealing explicitly to black workers against migrants, right? And trying to drive these wedges in, you know, in what would be a real working class constituency, because that's not what they want. But, you know, to your second point, which is the crucial one, I think, this is effective on the one hand because of material conditions, right? On the other one hand, because of the devastation wrought by NAFTA, the real devastation of communities, white, black, and brown. And the ability to then use that narrative to build resistance to it, and by the absolute uselessness of the Democrats who made this mess, right, and who did lead and develop policies that left behind a whole bunch of poor white people, right, and I think this is where we need to cut through those sort of, I think, difficult debates around the election that said, oh, was it class or was it race? And to understand that it was the ways in which economic abandonment can harden into white supremacy in white communities. I mean, that's clear. We know that. Mike Davis did a good breakdown of factory closings in communities that flipped, to Trump from Obama and showed, you know, in other words, people that may have voted for Obama were willing to vote, for Trump. Yeah. Based on shifts in their economic, realities, and these were key constituencies in the last election. I think we need to take the Trump constituency absolutely deadly serious. That doesn't mean saying, oh yeah, it's all about class. Let's forget about these divisive race things. No, but it means realizing that people can become white supremacists and racists when that's what when that's the solution that's offered to them. And when the Democrats refuse to offer other alternatives, and when the radical left refuses to speak to them, and that's the task of the radical left, is to try to build, a revolutionary culture that doesn't appeal to their racism, which, you know, some on the left have even made this argument. It's not a good argument. The point is not to appeal to their racism, but the point is to give alternative explanations for their economic realities.
Mm-hmm. Well, just, after the holidays are over, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be talk about the elections in 2018, but I mean, do you have any thoughts? I mean, I mean, for us, it would be, you know, promoting and talking about struggles and the things that people are doing, you know, in the communities. And that's what's real. But I'm just curious, what do you think revolutionaries should be thinking about, like, as, you know, the drumbeat for elections will get larger in 2018 for the Democrats?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can expect much of anything of the Democrats. If the Democrats don't want to commit a quick suicide, then they will, you know, bring forward some kind of populist candidate, although they seem to be hell-bent on preventing that from happening. You know, the machinery seems too strong, and they seem too fucking oblivious to the dynamics of the world around them to even grasp that. At the same time, I feel like the Republicans are going to pull away from their own populism out of fear of losing the next election over repulsion caused by someone like Trump. So it could be very interesting, which is that the real dynamics of the world call for a populist solution. And that's what brought Trump so unexpectedly to power. And yet, I think, you know, I think the Republicans may pull away, and the Democrats may refuse to engage, meaning that no one will be actually paying attention to what's happening in the world around them.
Right. Well, you know, one last overarching question. You know, in our last podcast with you, we were kind of at the point where Trump was starting to push for health, quote unquote, healthcare reform. Just looking at now what's happened so far, I mean, there's been obviously so many things. I mean, so many controversies, Charlottesville to North Korea. But I'm just curious, like, looking at the Trump administration, is it falling apart to the point where no one seems to be taking it seriously and it just doesn't matter as much anymore? Or where do you think the regime is at right now? I'm trying to ask.
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it's been this slow rolling disaster from the beginning, though, right? And I think one of the questions that as revolutionaries we need to ask ourselves is, does it matter, right?
Right.
That it's a disaster, because that seems to be the Democratic line, is that it's such a disaster. Look, isn't it like we can fucking laugh about it in The New Yorker, right? But no, right. If no one gives a shit, and if this disaster is still governing, and if this disaster is still making people's everyday lives hell and rolling back, you know, just the most basic policies that we need to live, then that's not helping us at all. Now, of course, like the failure to repeal the Affordable Care Act and all these things are failures. But what they're doing on the sly, you know, in the budget and all these other things, is really brutal. And, you know, I think the Republican Party has opted to stick with Trump, which wasn't guaranteed from the beginning. There was the possibility they would ditch him. But it seems like they're going to stick with him, and they're going to let him be this sort of, like, you know, bizarre emperor with no clothes that they, you know, while they continue to govern, behind the scenes. What's difficult for us is that we have to be, you know, we have to struggle in the ways that befit this sort of strange situation. It's not a normal situation. And as you put it earlier, we need to build movements. We need to build them on the ground. We need to continue to build movements that fight deportation, movements that fight, racist police violence. We need to do so in ways that are shared, right? We need, you know, people on the ground resisting and building, you know, communal structures for self-defense against both, against policing, against deportation raids in migrant communities. And, you know, understanding that these are in many ways the two faces of a Trumpian fascism. That, you know, and the way it operates on the ground. And those structures are really what is going to be our legacy of this period of struggle. It's not going to be what happens on the level of the Democratic Party. And it's not going to be, you know, what happens in the level of, you know, of public discourse if those, you know, if those structures are not established and, you know, and built and developed. We can punch as many Nazis as we want. And believe me, like, I'm all for that. But we also need to be building these community movements for, you know, for real power and real resilience for the very difficult years that are to come.
But hey, thanks so much for joining us. Check out George Ticarello Marr on Twitter. Check out his book, Decolonizing Dialectics, and among other works. And thanks so much, and we'll have you on again.
Yeah, dope. Thanks for having me.